like our logic on the gapping app is, hey, when your peak height falls by 15% and your carry gaps like shrink from 12 yards down to 8 yards, like, hey, that's when you should start to consider going to a hybrid. But that intermediary option is to switch from a Blueprint T or Blueprint S to an I-230.
This is The Tournament Code.
We appreciate you joining us, Chris. We started off this year, season two of The Tournament Code, and I know you did a little bit of research to make sure to kind of understand what we're about and what things were going to look like. One of the things that you probably weren't prepared for, because we added it in, is the Putview Books opening tee shot, the Putview Books first tee shot, which is our sponsor, Putview Books. Kind of as an icebreaker for a conversation with our guests, we just have an initial trivia question to make things a little more conversational, to get things going. So the first one for you, we'll just have one. And if we needed to have a mulligan or a breakfast ball, then we can have one. We just had on JC Deacon, who's the coach over at Florida. And I made it a little bit too hard, I think, as far as questions go. I overestimated how much he would know about historical college golf championships. So this one will make relatively benign. The question is, prior to the invention of rubber, what were golf balls made out of?
You would think I would know that.
There's two answers I'll accept, and one of them is what they used to be called, sort of.
Oh, it's like a guttery something coming to mind, but
The guttery ball did exist. That was in the later.
I also 1800s. Feel like feathers were like one point a real thing.
That there we go. Like, there you go. Yep.
Okay.
The feathery is what those used to be called. Wood or feathers. Either one was a correct answer. So good pull there.
Took a little diving into the memory bank.
It's tough being put on the spot like that. Well, perfect. Let's kind of talk about what you're doing right now. You're at Ping. What are you up to?
Yeah, I am the fitting science manager at Ping. So trying to develop new fitting tools for our, I guess, mainly our fitters would be the primary audience. So big project that we have currently going on is this Ping Copilot tool. And that hosts kind of all of our fitting knowledge in one spot for fitters to go to. So a couple highlights there is we have a launch efficiency tool, which kind of tells fitters what to do on a driver's side in terms of what are the best target launch and spin conditions. We have within drivers also a strokes gained club compare. So that's very valuable for fitters in terms of comparing gamer versus the club they fit someone into. And so we look at that data all the time. And like we recently pulled it out and saw that on average, our G430 is gaining, I think, 5 yards of distance and 10 feet of dispersion relative to someone's gamer. And so that's a shot and a half gain that we can say, hey, like G430 drivers are doing really well. And then the big one's the gapping app, which allows a fitter to put in their 7-iron numbers and we can predict all of the other clubs in a player's bag and figure out when they should swap from what their longest iron should be, what fairways and hybrids they should play, what their wedge setup should be. That's a super valuable tool for, we actually, even our latest feature is blending. So we just came up with the Blueprint S and Blueprint T irons. And something that our tour players are doing is they'll go Blueprint T kind of short irons up through maybe 7-6 iron, and then they swap over to Blueprint S. And so we built into the gapping app, like what happens to the ball flights when you go from Blueprint T to Blueprint S or Blueprint S to I-230. So always trying to add new features there. We have a shaft app that gives you a shaft recommendation for both your driver and 7-iron. And then I think we're going to talk about it for sure, but Ballnamic's a fitting tool that I spent a lot of time on. I think that's now 2-ish years in the market. And then I get a big one that just came out recently was a wedge app. So we worked really hard on creating an app. Had a couple of commercials with Victor Hovland showcasing how his wedge games improved recently. And a big thing there was we came with a new S159 line of wedges, and we wanted to make a big push in the wedge space. And we knew that we had six grinds. We had gone from our typical four of kind of pretty simple. You got a wide sole, a standard sole, a thin sole, and then an E grind, which is really good for bunker play. I think that was a pretty clear message for fitters. And we're like, hey, we're going to throw in two new grinds at you. We're going to throw a B grind at you and an H grind at you. And it's like, now we got six grinds. Grinds are already confusing to consumers. I think our fitters could follow the three split, but now you got five in the E grind. And so there's definitely a push to be like, how can we make this as simple as possible? And so that was a fun project to work on with. Got to coordinate making an app. Like, I now know the behind the scenes of how much it takes to have a software team build an app, to get our logic going, to get marketing behind it. It's a pretty remarkable cross-functional effort to get that going. But that was been really well received. Had a lot of people go through it, and fitters are like, oh yeah, this makes sense. Now we have two. We can have someone go through it. They get two grinds at the end. And it's been fun to work on that logic side and try to make it as easy as possible for both fitters and consumers. So I touched on a bunch of things, but yeah, we got wedges, we got irons, drivers, fairwoods, and we're going to make a push on putters this year. So trying to cover all our bases.
Yeah, Ping's always been very innovative as far as tying in technology with the equipment. I can remember a long, long time ago, probably 15 years ago, back pretty soon after iPhone was released, which a lot of people are so young, they don't remember that. But back when the iPhone was released, Ping soon after had the attachment that you could put on your putter, and then you could map your putting stroke. So you guys have been on the forefront in a lot of ways on that. One of the things that I was interested in, we talked with a guy who does AI fitting that is not specifically focused on any brand, so brand agnostic AI fitting. That was Damon Burrow, and I can't remember what his company was called, maybe Swing AI or something like that. But one of the challenges that they ran into whenever you're trying to fit somebody, and that's hence the necessity of AI, but also the difficulty in maybe working in the back end as far as trying to derive some sort of predictive power, is in an eye comparing across clubs, comparing essentially the infinite number of options that you possibly have with clubs, and really the amount of good swings that a consumer can make, even a high quality consumer like a PGA Tour player. There's only so many good reps that they're able to make that you could never possibly make the number of comparisons necessary to drive any sort of major statistical significance, hence the necessity of making predictions. Tell us a little bit about what that process looked like for you on the back end, trying to have some drive predictive power from limited number of repetitions or limited data, not in the sense that you guys are gathering limited data on the backside, but when a consumer comes in, how many swings are you recommending for them to take with a fitter, with their gamer, versus what they're trying to get fit for? And how are you guys predicting what's going to be best for them?
Yeah, I think that applies to every part of the bag. I instantly thought of our gapping prediction. I thought of our ballnamic algorithms. I thought of our driver fitting. I think most applicable to what you're saying is driver fitting, where ideally want to be able to say, hey, you have your gamer, it goes this far, here's your dispersion, and we have the driver G430 you got fitted into, here's how far it goes, here's your dispersion. And we would love in an ideal world for you to hit 5 to 10 shots with each of those clubs. And I think you start to get distance numbers pretty quickly. It's that dispersion piece, which takes a lot of shots to get a really statistically significant value. I do actually think it's remarkable how quick you can determine someone's skill level off of 10 to 20 shots. I think I looked at it at one point and probably 20 driver shots, and you could tell their handicap to like within plus or minus two, or their driving handicap in particular. And I think it actually makes sense that you go on a PGA Tour range and you see them hit drivers and you know they're carrying them around 300 and they're not really going outside of a 30 yard plus or minus 30 yard wide window for the most part. And you get a 10 handicap in there and they're hitting it 50 yards shorter and that dispersion is twice as wide. So you're pretty quick to be able to figure out someone's handicap. I think maybe differences between clubs take a little more work, but it is possible to do it. And we would recommend as many as you can, but you definitely run into limitations. So I think 5 to 10 is kind of that sweet spot of like, you're going to get some signal and also not tire out the golfer too much, but probably not enough to say definitively. I know Marty deals with this and Sasha deal with this on the Stack Putting app where they're trying to have you go through a protocol on the putting side. And it's like one round, you can get a hint of which putter's better. But if you really want to be able to figure out A versus B, you want to do 5 18-hole rounds with one putter and then 5 18-hole rounds with another putter. And so that's where, when you can leverage technology, we can actually make some really big assists. So the thought of like where we've made the most help possible is with our like gapping app algorithms. So we ask someone to hit a 7-iron and all we need is like a representative good shot. So that can be one solid strike. It could be three pretty good shots, take the average. And it's like, okay, well, how do you figure out a gapping for that player? And if they were to do this in a fitting or range scenario, it's like, you got to hit 5 good shots with each club, go all the way through like lob wedge to driver to figure out all your distances. And you're already, it's 13 times five, you're 65 shots in, taking a minute per shot. Like that math easily goes over an hour of time spent. And it's like, well, and the player's going to get tired. So like by the time you're hitting a 3-wood there, they're losing some speed or they're warming up and just all sorts of things go wrong there. And we have at Ping, I'm not sure the latest number, but it's over 750,000 player test shots that we've recorded and tagged with the player, what club they're hitting. And so to build our gapping app, we looked at, okay, for every iron that we release, we need to do a gapping protocol. So we need to have someone hit 4-iron through pitching wedge for that set or 3-iron through pitching wedge for that set. And even that we know is too many clubs for someone to hit in a player test. So we have them split up and they'll do, I don't know, 4 through 7-iron one day and then 8-iron through gap wedge the second day. And we have to do a little bit of piecing together. But I can leverage all those shots and say, okay, when someone switched from a 7-iron to a 6-iron, there were some really clear averages in terms of how their performance changed. Like their ball speed went up by 6 miles an hour. Their launch went down by 2 degrees. Their spin rate went down by 1,000 RPM. And so I think it's probably 2 years ago where I just like poured over all these hundreds of thousands of shots for a month straight and just like, okay, let's figure out what happens when we go 7 to 6 to 5 to 4, when we go from 7 to 8 to 9 to pitching wedge. And so we're now really comfortable as when this person comes in with their 7-iron, we can predict out that 8-iron, 9-iron pitching wedge really accurately and probably better than if they were just to take their 3 shots and who knows exactly how well they hit them. And then just keep on layering on. So it's like, okay, now we know how they'll hit their 4-iron. We can predict. We now do tests where we do 4-iron versus 4-hybrid versus 7-wood or 3-iron versus 3-hybrid versus 5-wood. And so now we can layer on, okay, now we know what your 4-iron is going to do. We can predict your 4-hybrid. We can predict your 7-wood. We can predict your 3-hybrid, we can predict your 5-wood, we can predict your 3-wood. And so now we have all these clubs that are really well predicted. And we have it nuanced where it's like, okay, we know when a slow speed player comes in, these are their tendencies. When a fast player comes in, these are their tendencies. When they're high spin, this is what we see. So that's I think we're pretty confident how well the algorithm works. Like most people come in, they're like, wow, you got all those distances within a couple yards. And that allows us to make some pretty smart predictions as to, when someone comes in, their 7-iron's at 5,500 spin, you kind of intuitively know that's going to be maybe tough by the time they get to a 5-iron. And we can see that in our predictions where it's like, okay, that 5-iron's starting to go pretty low. They might want to consider a 5-hybrid. And so that's definitely one where, I guess, going back to the original question, like those predictive algorithms just save so much time. Instead of having to hit those over an hour of shots on the range, we have 5 minutes of getting your 7-iron numbers and then instantly get your entire bag gapped out. And someone could come in, they can fit into the G430, they're hitting it 10 yards further, and we can say, okay, here's how far you're going to hit every single club in your bag as a result of getting that 10 yards on a 7-iron. I would say I wouldn't always classify it as AI. It's a little more kind of simple trade-offs in my mind, but it's really powerful in terms of how much time it saves and what it can do for a golfer in a fitting.
I know that Ping famously invented the cavity back iron, and for the longest time, that's all you guys made was cavity back irons. Do you guys consider the Blueprint a muscle back? And if so, what was the reason to make that switch and start producing muscle back irons?
It definitely was not our traditional iron style, not a cavity back. And that came directly from feedback from our tour department. I think Bubba was probably one of the pioneers pushing for. I think Louis Oosthuizen was another name that was like very vocal about want a club that was easier to work the ball with. And so I know when our first Blueprint was released, Bubba was out on the range testing it, like seeing how he could draw, seeing how he could hit fades. And there was a strong desire from that tour side of things to provide that club. And we felt like we were missing out on a club that tour players wanted. And it was one of those, in order for, I think, I don't know, the Solheims to accept releasing that club, which is very non-traditional from a Ping standpoint, it was like, we are not targeting at this at all, the masses. We do not think this will help your average player play with better golf. But we think there is a need. I think Marty in his podcast mentioned how to get that next level of iron play, like working into pins, is actually super valuable. Like that's not even like an average tour player request. That's only like the best of the best need that ability. And that's kind of what that Blueprint was designed for. So, and then I think even when we released it, we have this WebFit tool that I helped build some of the algorithms behind. And so that's your general consumer goes through it, tells you their handicap, and we recommend their full set of Ping clubs. And we did not include the Blueprint in that recommendation system. It was, we don't want your 5 handicap to consider playing this club. But we did see the need for it on the tour player side.
When it comes to working with tour players, I know obviously you guys have a lot of the major names that you've worked with over the past. And then also recently you worked with Bryson with some of his irons. When it comes to specific requests from tour players, how involved are you personally in that? And as far as trying to map things out and take consideration as to what tour players need, whether they be helpful for them or whether sometimes the request might be maybe idiosyncratic might be the word, but whether they're not necessarily the most helpful to them, but that's what they like. And so you do it for them. What recommendations are you making to players in that regard? And how are you presenting any, if any, data to them saying, I get you want this and here's how it may affect you?
I definitely don't see the lion's share of requests. I think the ones that I've been most involved with are some of the ball decisions. So a player who's under a Titleist ball deal wants to consider options. We can lay out, okay, here's what we saw in testing for Pro V1X, Pro V1. We've done some of the testing on the tour only, left dot, right star balls. So we can basically break down the pros and cons of those different balls for sure. One fun one that has come up a couple times is for the Ryder Cup and Solheim Cup, you have to play alternate shot. And so both times I've had requests of, okay, what are balls that we have players playing? Bridgestone balls, we got Titleist balls, we got Callaway balls. Like, what balls are similar and different? What balls can we pair people up together with? And so that's sneakily very important. If a player is a high spin player and they're used to playing a low spin ball, doubling them up and pairing up with a high spin golf ball is going to be a double whammy of like poor performance. So it actually helps to know, okay, these players should be grouped in like this low spin ball category. These players should be grouped in a high spin ball category. So that's probably the most like fun, direct usage I've had. I know we've definitely had some pushes for encouraging some longer length driver shafts. And we've seen kind of Victor and Neiman embrace that. but maybe still doing a little bit less than I would like to do, and haven't quite seen all the. I know I got to see a bit of the Bryson build. The iron build was quite a process for our tour department, but I was not directly involved with that.
I get that. I think going to the Bryson build, even though you weren't directly involved with it, I wanted to talk about, because you're involved in the fitting, gapping, etc. We've talked about this with a couple different fitters, and I can't remember. We might have even talked about this with Marty, even though that wasn't at the time the Bryson was around, but around single length shafts or similar length shafts, so there's a few different concepts out there. One, single length, everything's one single length, or similar length shafts in the sense that you might have certain combos or comparisons. We'll call it like pitching wedge 9, or call it 987, 654, something like that. Those pairs or those groups have the same length of shaft. Tell us one about generally speaking, whether you know from practical experience, practical testing, or from a theoretical perspective based on your gapping, what you would expect from a player as far as the different, without making any sort of adjustments otherwise, what sort of changes would be happening to ball flight, et cetera, what sort of changes you'd be looking for to have to make sure that ball flight, et cetera, was appropriate. And we're assuming in this case, a not a tour player, but a high quality player, about a scratch golfer. So you know their swing speed is pretty high, relatively speaking, and the ball's, no matter, generally speaking, if they're playing with a normal set of clubs, the ball's going to be coming into the green at a general trajectory and spin rate that it'll hold the green, as opposed to a 16 handicap hitting a 5-iron in that's coming in at 10 degrees or something of that nature. So tell us kind of what to expect, what sort of modifications you might make in a situation. And then lastly, whether you expect something like that to ever catch on or be used.
Yeah, I think we have tested the single length iron set idea. And I think the big takeaway that we had is length is super helpful for, I would maybe focus on like the 4-iron, 5-iron end of things. Like you'd have an extra inch and a half of length there that you're working with on a standard set. And that's really helpful for ball speed. That's probably the main thing that increases. And you get a little bit of launch and spin. You might get a little more like shaft lead going into impact. And so when you go single length, like that's the number one thing I'd expect. Like you need to be fast clubhead speed, so you have some landing angle to work with. And even then, as you get to that 4-iron, 5-iron side, you're really going to struggle to get that ball up in the air. And so Bryson, being one of the fastest guys on tour, he can get away with it, but I think he's still, those 4-irons and 5-irons are coming out really low and hot. And so I was thinking about like, okay, why did he get fit into our I-230 irons? I think when we did our kind of going back to blending, that we looked at what were the blending trade-offs between Blueprint T, Blueprint S, I-230, and those actually have some pretty clear height differences. So it's about a 10-foot like peak height difference between those three irons. Interestingly, part of the reason why the Blueprint T is a little bit lower is because its stock length is 1/4-inch shorter. And so we know how important that length difference is for differentiating that Blueprint T and Blueprint S iron. And so my hypothesis is that Bryson would hit his 4-iron and 5-iron a little bit low, even at his super high speed. And so having that 230 that would actually fly a little bit higher makes a lot of sense for him. It kind of offsets some of the pain that he might experience with the 7-iron length for a 4-iron. So that'd be the big thing. I think like in our testing, it's one of those where it's just not the most playable for someone who's below tour speeds, and probably not even that playable for your average tour speed golfer. And so if you are considering that, it's like you're probably gonna have to switch over to a hybrid much sooner than you maybe typically otherwise do. And then the flip side is the wedge side, where you're getting longer there. Guess you're gonna get a little more ball speed, just raw from having more length. And we haven't really done the testing there. I don't think we're particularly considering going to a 7-iron length lob wedge, so don't have a whole lot of test data to go off of there. But I've heard kind of the general like floating around the golf coach world is that it could help on a bunker shot where the extra speed's helpful, but it might be a little bit tougher on some of the touch and feel shots. We want to get a little more, open up the club a little more, get your hands low. But yeah, I don't have a whole lot of direct insight there.
Got it. No, that is helpful to talk through. It's not something I'm necessarily considering doing, but it's one of my pet hypotheses that I someday want to mess around with more when I have infinity budget and can mess around with a lot more of that stuff.
Yeah, I think the more practical one that you might consider is like group it. So maybe your 6, 7, 8 are the same length, and your 4, 5 are the same length, and your pitch and wedge gap wedge are the same length, but having a bit of a length difference definitely is advantageous.
Well, what would your opinion be on like having a mixed set of the 7, 8, 9 blueprints and the 4, 5, 6 and the i20s or whichever model's out now? What would be the pros and cons of that?
Yeah, I think the big one that I kind of see from like purely math background is the peak heights of 7-iron will tend to be one of your highest irons that you hit in terms of peak height. People tend to flight their wedges like a little bit lower. And then you kind of have the same kind of falling off from the 6-iron, 5-iron side. And so like our logic on the gapping app is, hey, when your peak height falls by 15% and your carry gaps like shrink from 12 yards down to 8 yards, like, hey, that's when you should start to consider going to a hybrid. But that intermediary option is to switch from a Blueprint T or Blueprint S to an i230. So you can basically, like a lot of times you're going to have your 6-iron drop off a little bit and then your 5-iron drop off a little bit more, but still playable. And then that 4-iron goes too low and too short of gaps. It's like, hey, you need a 4 hybrid. But it's still that 5-iron point where that club is still kind of dropping off a little bit in height and carry gap. And that's where it's actually really, really good to insert in that i230. And it's like you then get that bump right back up to where your 7-iron is. It's super playable. And you can, a lot of times for that faster player, it's like, hey, your 7-iron and 6-iron are great at Blueprint TRS. And then i230 works perfectly as a 5-iron and 4-iron. And it eases you into maybe a 3-hybrid, 3-wood type solution. So I think that height playability portion is really nice. I think you feel it as a golfer. I know like I play a 3-iron and the gapping up says I should play a 3-hybrid. And I know I'm coming into a par 3 green and I'm like, I don't think I can hold the green here. Like I would really, like you intuitively just kind of feel like, I'm going to struggle to hit this ball high enough and get to stop. And that's kind of shows up in the data of like, hey, you probably should be playing a 3-hybrid. But it's also goes into player preferences. Like I like having a 3-iron that can help the tee and keep it low and chase it out. So that's kind of the consideration that a golfer is always making. But yeah, I would definitely do it for playability across the set.
And if you're not stuck with the single ball rule, then you can make those decisions. And kind of switching gears here, that way we're not stuck talking on my pet hypotheses. We talked some with Marty about Ballnamic, and he told us that we should talk with you more about it, which is fun for us to get to do. Tell us a little bit about Ballnamic, its genesis, and your involvement in it.
Yeah, I think it's fun because it grew up from a lot of different directions. We had an Nflight fitting software, I think back in 2008, 2009, our VP of engineering, Paul Wood, did a lot of the logic behind that. And that was similar to the gapping app where it was, hey, we can predict if you give us your 7-iron numbers, we can predict when you should go to hybrid, all that sort of similar stuff that I've been talking about. And one of the big issues there was people were hitting range balls. And so he needed to make a conversion between range balls to premium balls, possibly switch between different premium balls. So he started testing out the different premium balls in the market, the different types of range balls. So you can convert when a fitter says, hey, I'm using this type of range ball, convert it back to premium. So we always were very interested in golf balls, and we kind of continuously tested out balls over the years. So we want to see how is the Pro V1 developing from 2011 to 2023, Pro V1X. and also helps for us because we want to make sure that we're using kind of an average ball in the market or the most likely ball for a consumer to play. We might get into some funny club design areas if we start optimizing for a high spin ball or a low spin ball. We want to be fairly neutral in that regard. So we're definitely following the progression of balls from 2008. And then I'd say it's maybe in the, I don't know my exact dates, but maybe say 2019, we come out with the G400 Max. And that's kind of a bit of a game changer. It's like the highest MOI club we've released. And Marty, I know at the time, was like, man, I really want to play this club. Like the idea of having the ultimate forgiveness off a tee shot would be huge for me. And so he goes and works with our tour rep, Ken Oates, and says, hey, can you fit me into this G400 Max? And so he's fitting, going through a fitting process, and he knows what our target launch and spin should be from kind of our launch efficiency work that we've done. And it's like, okay, he should be at 12 and 2400 spin, and he's hitting this G400 Max, and he's loving the forgiveness, but it's 2800 spin. And so it's like, man, like everything's perfect. Like it's gonna be an amazing club, but he's 400 RPM spin too high. And Kenton sees this. They both see this like, man, okay, we need to lower, but we don't want to lower. You don't really want to lower the loft there. Like then you go from 12 down to 11 or 12 down to 10. And so Kenton's like, hey, hold on a second. I got something for you. And goes in the back, pulls out a ball and places it on a tee and says, hey, hit this, Marty. And Marty hits it, really good golfer, comes out 10 feet lower. And he's like, that's perfect. That's exactly what I wanted. Like that's a penetrating flight. I've got like forgiveness and a really good ball flight. We are good to go. And then look over TrackMan and it's 12 and 2800. And Marty's like, but I just saw that thing. That thing flew like 10 feet lower. Like what just happened? And Ken's like, no, that's the ball. Like that's perfect. Like that's what the ball does. It just lowers your peak height. And it hits another one, hits a couple more. And it's like same thing, 2800, but the ball flight's 10 feet lower. And he's like for this ball, which is the left dot, Titleist has changed the aerodynamic profile so that the spinner is still the same as the Pro V1X roughly, but the flight, the aerodynamics of that golf ball are lower. And I think that's kind of a light bulb moment for Marty of like, hey, if we can pair someone's club fitting with their ball fitting, like we can get to like the ultimate combination. We can have no sacrifices. We can get that ultimate forgiveness club that might spin a little bit higher, but we can pair it with the ball that flies a little bit lower and we'll have a really, really perfectly fit combination. And so that definitely was the inspiration. I think Marty always talks about, hey, like the future of fitting is getting these tour fitting solutions to the everyday golfer. And so that was kind of the CG shifter idea was, hey, can we put like people, tour players would do heel in the toe or heel in the heel. And now you can just change away the back of the club and get that same kind of adjustability. So Marty's like, okay, we need to do this. We need to have ball fitting, be able to provide that way of get someone's driver conditions, pair them with the right ball, get someone's iron conditions, pair them with the right ball. And I think, so then it's like on my side, it's like, how are we actually going to do this? Like, how do we pair up? How do we simulate golf ball performance? Like, how do we take all the golf balls on the market and accurately characterize them? And so I had worked a lot on what our ball flight algorithm was, how to predict if someone has 170 ball speed, 12 launch, 2100 spin, how high is that ball fly, how far does it fly. And so to get a little into the weeds, but hopefully it'll stop me, I guess, if it gets confusing. But ball flight is like fairly well known in terms of physics. Like you got gravity working on it, you have lift, and you have drag. Those are like the three main factors. And they're determined by the weight of the golf ball, surface area, and everything's pretty known in that equation, except for two very important bits, which is the coefficient of lift and the coefficient of drag. And so those are just, they change on the dimple pattern. So if you have a ball with no dimples, it's going to have a wildly different amount of lift and drag than a ball with dimples. And so there's been plenty of tests where that ball goes 100 yards short or something. And so you have to dial in, what is that lift and drag that a ball experiences? And the way that people do it is the big value that kind of underpins it is called alpha, but it's the spin rate divided by the ball speed. And so you have to have the correct coefficient of lift and coefficient of drag for every single alpha value. So a ball comes out at kind of a knuckleball with a 1,000 spin and 180 ball speed. You have to know what to simulate the lift and drag at. The ball comes out at lob wedge with 10,000 spin and 80 ball speed. You got to know what the lift and drag should be. And that changes from, I don't know, 0.1 is one of the numbers to like 0.8. So you might have low lift in that knuckleball drive situation. It's down 0.1. You might have high lift and high drag when it's up at that lob wedge situation. It's 0.8. And what I found is that that curve is unbelievably sensitive. And so we kind of have a curve that underpins how we predict the golf ball flight. And if you shift, I was trying to do this like right before got on here, is like if you shift your lift up by, so I did a stock, like let's say 175 ball speed, 12 launch, 2500 spin, that's carrying 302 yards and 118 feet. And I was like, okay, let's shift this lift, this coefficient lift number up by 0.02. So we're talking about like 0.1, 0.8 is kind of our parameters, and we're doing a 0.02 shift. So pretty microscopic. And that increased the carry by 9 yards from 302 to 311 and increased the height by 20 feet from 118 to 139. And so super sensitive. And it's like, okay, well, what happens if you, instead of increasing the lift by 0.02, you increase the drag by 0.02. And the carry went from 302 to 284, so went down by 18 yards, and the height went down from 118 feet to 110. And so it's like, all it takes is just micro tweaks, and you get 20 yard different carry numbers, 20 feet different height numbers. And I'm just thinking, man, it's just not going to be possible to like accurately predict a golf ball's flight, like for every single golf ball in the market. And I know that when at first we're just trying to get this overall curve correct, like it took me a month to like tweak things and like make sure we're good for drivers, three woods, seven irons. Like there's a whole host of combinations you have to get right. And I think we had an intern at the time who was like, no, I think we should actually try it. Like that'd be sweet. Like if we can predict out this is how your drivers are going to fly with this ball, like this is how your seven irons are going to fly with this ball, like that will kind of unlock the next level of fitting. And I think the unlock was like, if we actually just like localize, if we just focus on fast driver conditions or slow driver conditions or seven iron, we kind of keep them a little bit separate. Don't try to figure out everything at once. We can actually do something pretty accurate. And so we now do driver testing at fast speed, slow speed, seven iron testing. So we have kind of these discrete buckets that we're looking at, and we're able to back out the math of, okay, we do the testing, we see that a ball flies on our fast driver test, it flies 5 yards further than we expect and 3 feet higher. And we can run the math and say, okay, to get those exact carry and height numbers, it has to have this change in lift and drag. And so now we do that for every ball. Okay, for a fast driver, this is the lift and drag profile for it. For a slow driver, this is the lift and drag profile. And now I think that for me, that was like a big aha moment of like, hey, we actually can accurately predict a golf ball's performance across kind of a full sweep of speeds and launch conditions. And that was a nice and fun like collaborative effort between me and Marty of like, what are the most important things we care about? How do we design this questionnaire? How do we tie it into our testing? Having the ability to accurately simulate out a golf ball's flight allowed us to do like fun things about figuring out wind performance. So like, how does this ball perform into a 30 mile per hour headwind, 40 mile per hour headwind? That's going to be something that he cares about. He knows that's super important for a tournament golfer. Like, you don't want that ball ballooning offline as soon as you're playing in a bit of wind. Same thing for a seven iron. Like, you can feel that, hey, a low spin ball, like that kind of knuckleball's on you. It's a little bit harder to curve, which can be pros and cons for different golfers. So we started like the simulation side and the questionnaire side, like what Marty cared about as a tournament golfer, what we could do on the simulation and testing side, kind of all work together into this overall survey and recommendation algorithm. So it's fun to have everything kind of work together of what do people care about in tournaments, what can we predict on the golf ball side. And I think we're pretty happy with how everything turned out.
Absolutely. When it comes to golf ball performance on the golf course and when testing it, one of the things, I mean, again, we talked with Marty a little bit about this, was we talked about flyers and how golf ball, I assume that was one of those things that was relatively, maybe not solved, but that flyers were more of a function of essentially the launch conditions than the golf ball itself. But from what it says on Ballnamic, from what it seems like from your testing, that each golf ball, even if you have what we would call probably similar golf balls, like four-piece urethane golf balls, can have different flyer profiles. Tell us a little bit about how something like that could happen, where some people might say, all four-piece urethane golf balls are essentially identical, barring, you know, a few different things.
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely an active area of research for us. But we're interested in it on the wedge design side as well as the golf ball side. So I guess in our testing, we know for sure that this is a thing. You can have a premium urethane golf ball and you put one in wet conditions. And so our test is take a lob wedge, spritz it with a water bottle like two or three times and hit on Pingman or have a person hit it. And I guess for reference, like a dry spin might be around 9,000, might be around 10,000. And we do that on our Pingman robot. So it's super repeatable. We spray the water and we'll do four different golf balls and we'll see some spin at 10,000. So they actually have their spin rate go up in the wet, which is kind of remarkable. And then we'll have others that just plummet. So we've seen 6,000, 5,000 RPM of spin. So it definitely happens. We also see on the wedge side where we're pretty proud of our S159, like retained spin wet conditions. So we have a similar, pretty stable performance between dry and wet. Whereas other competitors maybe have a bit of fall off when they might have a 20%, 30% fall off in wet conditions. And you definitely see it for sure on like someone's gamer wedge. If you've been playing a wedge for a year or two heavily, the grooves wear down. That's where you get that plummet from 10,000 to 5,000 really quick. So it definitely happens. Why has it happened is something we're, I would say, working on. I think there's definitely conformance between the grooves and the ball that's underpinning a lot of it. And so the cover thickness would be probably cover thickness, firmness, ability to compress within the grooves. Groove design on our manufacturer side is super important as well. So we're trying to adjust those levers on the club design side to make the ball grab as much as possible in all conditions. And then I'd say the third piece is like a hydrophobicity side where different cover materials kind of shed water versus if it's hydrophilic, we kind of see this difference of like hydrophobic, the water will beat up and it won't take up much space on the face and that allows for more clean contact. And then other balls, it might just kind of like smother the entire surface. And it's like, you're just getting a wet impact no matter what. So it seems to be kind of three things going on there with wedge design, ball cover properties, and then also kind of that material and its hydrophobic properties.
For yourself personally, when you're practicing, playing, et cetera, what do you take away from your work and apply to it? I know that you do play golf. You're not just a guy who does only golf. You do play golf and you're not just playing golf theory. Tell us about what pieces of your work that you apply in your daily performance. Because I know Cooper and I have taken away a ton from our 80 plus interviews with guests at this point in time. We've taken away a ton and applied a ton in our own personal golf games.
Yeah, I'm definitely trying to personally ramp up my own tournament playing, which I think is helpful for the stress testing, what works and what doesn't. I think the most obvious one, if you watch me play, is that I need to work on reducing my curvature. So definitely get a little too heavy with the draws off the tee. And so that's an active area of working. And we know from our research that like, hey, if you can hit the ball straight, it will go further. It will probably be more control and 20-30 yard shop end isn't the move. But I think one of the bigger ones for wind play is we've done all this work on like wind sheets and what do you expect with a 5-10 mile per hour headwind. And I think I didn't have any, like my junior golf days was maybe, okay, so one club headwind and you're kind of ballparking it. And I now have a pretty good gauge of like, what is actually a 5 mile per hour wind? What is actually a 10 mile per hour wind? We have player tests where you're test get cuts off if it goes over 10 or 12 miles per hour. So I'm pretty sensitive to that kind of 10 mile per hour threshold. And then we've also built these wind sheets. I know Marty uses them a ton in tournaments. And so one of the big like numbers that sticks out to me is a 10 mile per hour headwind cuts most of your iron distances down by at a tour player speed by like 20 yards. And so that's like an instant, like, okay, like you can actually commit to hitting a 20 yard, like that'd be really hard to commit to otherwise. If you're telling me I'm 180 and I got to imagine this is a 200 yard shot, I wouldn't be able to do that without having the confidence in the numbers. And so I think that's really helpful of like, hey, hit 6 iron instead of 7 iron, like commit to it. I think that's definitely been a big one on my end. That'd be the first, probably the first couple that come to mind, but it definitely helps also playing with like so many good players in our office. We have, I was thinking about my own like personal golf development. I felt like as a junior, I won my like junior club championship when I was like 13 or 14. I didn't really have a whole lot of like players that were near me that were better than me. So I didn't really know what the levels were to get better. And then I came to Ping and it's like, okay, I have someone over here. I was a 4 handicap me when I got to Ping. It's like, I got someone over here as a 2 handicap. I got someone over here scratch. I got +2. We got +4. We got winning amateur events. We got Marty who's making cuts in majors. And it's like, I've got the absolute layout of like what it takes to get from scratch to +6. And so that's been really helpful of like, okay, this is actually what the person does when they hit 10 seven irons in a player test. And it's like, I know I can hit one good shot, but it's like they're actually hitting that good shot 9 out of 10 times or 10 out of 10 times. It's like, that's actually the like consistency that I have to strive for to get better. So that's slightly unrelated from like the equipment side, but I think it's been really helpful for me in terms of knowing what to focus on, how to improve to get to the next level.
Absolutely. When it comes to non-work stuff and trying to get better, what are the steps that you are taking? You're talking about wanting to get in more, play more tournament golf, be competitive tournaments. What sort of steps are you taking outside of necessary things at work, which is kind of obvious, but golf instruction, speed work, any of those types of things?
Yeah, I'm probably not as great about taking lessons as I should be. I think I got a little bit, I don't know. I maybe didn't see progress when I was a junior golfer getting lessons. It never quite, like technique changes never quite clicked for me. So I may have steered away from them more than I should have. But there's probably two things that I've done to like make a specific effort to get better. One has been speed work for sure. When I got to Ping, I think I maybe could average like 170 ball speed on our player test, so fairly quick. And I think a couple of years later, like I hadn't been training much. And I think I had a player test over the winter where I was like 161 average. And like I maxed out. I like after test, I tried to hit one really hard and I was 164. I'm like, man, I'm a good like 10 miles an hour slower than when I started. And so I was kind of like, okay, let's try to train, see if I can get stronger, see if I can swing faster. And so kind of helped that Marty at the same time had his own pet theory that he wanted to get faster. And so the stack was in its early days. And so I know I did a couple programs there and saw a good like 5 to 10 mile per hour jump in club head speed. And I've continued taking those principles of like, hey, let's make sure that you get like at least, I don't know, 20, 30 hard swings a week. And if you're kind of in that mode of like really training it, do it 3 or 4 times a week. And so over the course of maybe 4 years after realizing like, man, I'm actually really slow, I've gotten over like 190 ball speed in like kind of the speed training session. So that's a good, I don't know, almost 30 mile per hour jump in 4 years. But it really helps that like now I can, I would say cruise around mid 170s on course. So that's definitely super helpful for just, yeah, playability and speed side of things. And then the other one that I'm recently working on is obviously it's okay, now I got faster, but it's like, okay, I got a little bit too much shot bend. I'm definitely not the most accurate golfer in the world. So it's like, how do I tighten in that offline side of things? And so this is a current project that I'm very actively working on. I started like at the beginning of the year, but I'll hit after work. I'll go and hit like 50 drivers on a launch monitor and keep track of like where they go, what's the distance offline, and I kind of set out like a 40 yard wide fairway to kind of measure myself and value it over time. And I knew my baseline going in was like 285 carry and 35 to 40% of fairways. I think like 37% was the number I had. And so clearly, if you're just gonna outside observer looking in, it's like, hey, that 37%, so that's a bit scary. And so I've been doing that for 3-4 months now, and I'm creeping up to the 50% mark. So there's definitely signs of improvement there. And so I want to keep on working on that. And I can notice. So I played my first tournament like a month ago, and I'm gonna keep on playing some more tournaments over the summer. And so I can see that the misses are shrinking a little bit, and there's signs of that translating over the golf course, which is promising.
Tell me about your decision to measure it in. So you have a 40-yard wide fairway, and that's, I mean, maybe it's self-evident, maybe I'm not thinking about it the right way. I'm never really sure if I'm measuring dispersion, there's a few different ways I would be thinking about measuring it. And I think the fairway percentage is probably that's the close to the easiest one, because you can just set your fairway wide and you can just measure that, and that gives you good ballpark accuracy. But in a situation where you're measuring this, why did you choose that versus some other measurement where you're looking at maybe the entire shotgun pattern, or you're looking at different percentiles of that? Whereas, like, because this obvious, but if you put 95% of your shots were within 50 yards, 25 each way, and 37% were within 40 yards, so 20 each way, then that's a scenario where you'd probably be like, all right, I'm actually, even though I'm not hitting a ton of fairways, I'm actually driving it pretty well, versus assuming that the remaining 5% up top there isn't 100 yard, isn't like 100 or 200 yard wide gap. Why? What's the rationale? In ease of measurement is a perfectly fine reason. What's the rationale, and what are the trade offs with how you're measuring that?
Yeah, I definitely monitor everything. So I, like, after the fact, I can look at like, hey, what's my offline standard deviation for all those shots? And I know, from a term perspective, it really makes sense to have that like 95% number. So it's like, hey, you can have that 60 yard wide shotgun and know where to aim and know where to center it. And I've done that for like some of our better players. Corey Bacon's won some amateur events, and he'll like ask me, like, hey, where would you aim on this hole coming up in tournaments? And it's one of those where it's like, I look at my data, and it's like, man, if I do my 95% shotgun, like, we are sadly, like, we're over 100 yards. Like, if we gotta find a fairway, like, we're just trying to aim it in the middle of the golf course and like keep it in play. And so I think there was a bit of like, I could keep the 95% number in my head. I could think about like range of outcomes, but I wanted to be somewhat like, hey, let's focus on hitting more good ones. That was kind of my, like, let's like frame our practice in a positive mindset. Like, I'd rather focus on like how many I can hit within 30 or 40. 40 was kind of like, I'm already struggling to hit a decent percentage of those. So let's not start at like a 20% number. I think there's some sort of like learning theory of like, do something challenging where you're maybe at 50% and you can work to 70 or 35% and try to work to 60, rather than, like, it's hard to get from 90 to 95. I think it's a little bit psychologically, like, you're then focused as like, hey, let's not make mistakes. If I said, hey, let's put a 60 yard wide fairway and let's try to hit 90% of those, I'm just like scared of making a bad swing, where I was like, hey, let's do 40 yards. I'm already struggling with that. And let's try to make more good swings. So there was definitely some like psychology thought to why I picked that. I think in my head, it's like, okay, if I get to 60%, which I think would be maybe a goal by the end of the year, like, then I would be, hey, let's shrink that down to 30 yards and like do the same process again of, hey, can we work from 40% up to 60%? And I'm hoping, I think I can also like track in the data that the number of foul balls is also shrinking as I hit a higher percentage of good ones. So I think it should all work together, but I wanted to frame my practice a little more positively.
I get that. I think we're coming close to the end here, but I had a few more questions. One, we never really talked about your background. Tell us kind of how you got into the game of golf, how you ended up over at Ping. If someone has listened this far, which hopefully a lot have, why should they be listening to you? I know you have a math background. Tell us a little bit about all that.
Yeah. I don't know how far back to go, but I played a bunch of sports growing up, played junior golf, played through high school, was not good enough to make the college team, but played club golf at Cornell, was a math major there. And so always had both the interest in math and in golf. Probably worth mentioning, my dad is Mark Brody, so he came up with the strokes gained stats, and so I was always very aware of kind of latest that was happening in the golf stats space. Like with actively, like I remember probably freshman year of college, like I was reading and proof editing his Every Shot Counts book, so I was aware of how he was breaking down like different performance of golfers. That was always super interesting to know. Okay, like here's how you can classify Rory's driving, because he's hitting it 310, he's hitting out of he measured in degrees, so a 3-degree window, 3-degree cone. And you can classify, okay, Jim Furyk is that same window, but he's 290, 285. So always super interested in that golf and math space, and was lucky enough to get an internship at Ping out of college. And that turned into a full-time job, first working in our test engineer analysis and testing department, but yeah, had a big focus on kind of understanding the golf physics side of things. So one of my first projects was looking at ball flight laws. And so that's given, hey, your face is pointed here, your path is here, where's that ball going to launch? And so that was the first thing I did. I dove into our focal/Enzo test data, where we can measure exactly the club's delivery and its launch conditions. And like the very short 2-cent summary there is your ball will fly 85% towards the face off a driver, and then it moves down to about 70% towards the face off a wedge. And so it was really cool to kind of see the underpinning data that kind of showed that trend. And then did a lot of kind of test data analysis in this analysis and testing role for a year, looking at player test data. There's just a gold mine of 750,000 shots that you could look at. Kind of built some of the basis of our gapping app analysis, and then moved on to, I was a head of fitting science before this, so kind of one person department, kind of looking at all things fitting and trying to assist with some of our design questions as well. Anytime there was like a question that was math related and I could apply some data to it, I think it was nice that the designers would come to me. So I did a lot of analysis on what should the bulge and roll be on our drivers, on our fairway woods. One of the big questions that I helped work with on our G430 fairway woods was, what's that trade-off between CG height and moment of inertia, MOI? And so a designer, Travis, came to me. He's like, I have 10 grams of discretionary mass. Like, should I prioritize moving the CG down, or should I prioritize increasing MOI? And we ran the analysis, and it's like, hey, like if you can, and that's a hard one, I guess, for us to answer previously. It was like, we have all these like trade-off curves of, okay, if you can improve aerodynamics, you can gain a mile an hour of club at speed. Or if you can improve launch and spin, you can maybe gain 3 yards on a center hit. Or if you can improve MOI, you get 10% more forgiveness. And all three of those things are different metrics. It's like, one's club at speed, one's launch and spin, one's percent forgiveness. And it was hard to be like, how do we get all those metrics to talk to each other? And it's kind of interesting that the way I was able to get them to all align is strokes gained. So it's like, okay, we can say that it's easier to like reframe strokes gained to yards, but the same idea of like, hey, can we get one single benchmark here for performance? And it's okay, we can translate aerodynamics from 1 mile an hour of club head speed to 2.5 yards. We can translate the launch and spin gains to 3 yards. We can translate 10% MOI to this. And I could break down, okay, if you do a 10% bump in MOI, you'll gain 1 yard of distance. But if you do a 0.2 drop in your CG location, you gain 7 yards of distance. And that became a really easy conversation to be, to go to the Solheims and say, hey, like, I know we haven't really dropped MOI too much in the past, but I promise you, like, we tried to run the analysis. It's worth it. Like, we're going to drop our MOI by 10-20%, but we're going to gain 5-7 yards in distance. And we're also going to help keep the dispersion pattern very similar by optimizing the bulge and roll. So super fun to be able to, like, everything kind of came full circle. It's like my dad's working on strokes gained when I'm a freshman in college, and I'm applying like strokes gained principles to things 10 years later. And so it's been super fun to have all those kind of pieces of my life tie together. And I'm very lucky to be doing fitting science stuff for Ping.
That is sweet. Well, we appreciate you taking the time to join us. The last question we ask every guest is the same, which is, if you could go back to yourself as a junior golfer and tell yourself just one thing, what would that one thing be?
Yeah, I would definitely, given my current struggles with driver, I'd definitely tell myself to hit more drivers. I grew up on a pretty short course where I could get away with hitting lots of three woods. So definitely work on drivers, work on speed, get comfortable with that club. That's a pretty big weapon for, you see it for Rory, you see it for Ludvig. All those guys on top are really, really good at driving. And then I think maybe the more meta one would be to kind of focus on improving. I think it's a little bit easier maybe as a junior golfer to get caught up in your day-to-day scores. And I think having habits of, like, how do you get better at something would be nice to have that long-term vision of, like, where do you want to get as a golfer? What kind of practice habits should you have to do that? And so having a good plan of that long-term goal is really important. So
very cool. Where can people find you on social media or anything like that? Follow the work you're doing at Ping, et cetera.
I'm not super active on social media, but Twitter's probably the most likely spot where I would post new things we're doing. So at Chris Brody on Twitter. We'll occasionally post about our latest fitting projects and my exploits to get faster, more accurate with driving. So that'd be a place to go.
Sweet. Be sure to follow Chris on social media. And if you're trying to find us on social media, you can find us on Instagram at The Tournament Code and on Twitter at Tournament Code. If you're listening to us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or YouTube, please like, subscribe, leave a rating, all the good stuff, so more people get to hear Chris talk, more people get to learn about how to play great tournament golf. We appreciate you taking the time to join us and look forward to diving deeper what it takes to play elite tournament golf.